Hey everybody, it's Nolan North, you know, Nathan Drake from Uncharted, and you're listening to the Geek Apocalypse podcast.
Hello everybody and welcome to the latest edition of the Geek Apocalypse podcast with yours truly, Mr. Stephen Hesse, brought with you from the rainy days of the northeast of England, because that's pretty much what it always is like, raining. Although yesterday, which is when this episode was recorded, it was unbelievably sunny and hot, and this particular episode was filmed at Back to Balance, which is a holistic workshop and wellness centre run by Nikki Robertson, amongst others, who is today's guest. And we sat in her office space and looked at the view of the River Tyne overlooking Gateshead, where you can see the Angel of the North and everything else. So if you're not from the UK, it is pretty much one of the best places you can look at Newcastle, because Newcastle is actually nice if you know where to look, but sometimes it looks a bit weird, but I love it because obviously I'm from here. And it was really, really nice. So myself and Ricky, who is the co-host of Mentally Sound, another show that I do, which Nikki Robertson is actually a contributor of now. She's going to be on at least once a month to talk about, you know, loads of holistic therapies, you know, psychiatry and all that kind of stuff. You know, not necessarily her expertise completely, but, you know, she knows people within this wellness centre, so she can talk about it with some good detail. And it's great because, you know, we can talk about it from an academic professional point of view, and obviously from our own experiences as well, which is kind of how you get, like, recovery in these particular situation. So she's really, really awesome. She's originally from South Africa, from Johannesburg, so we definitely talk about that and about having a practice there, obviously, because during the time she was starting that practice, I think she'd sort of like early 90s, obviously, you know, South Africa was a difficult country with the crime rate and everything. So we talk about that, and we talk about the fact her and her husband then moved to Malaysia to start a practice there. And what I found the most fascinating conversation we had, with me and Ricky and us herself, was talking about how she got to where she was now, because and also the cultural differences between essentially Africa, Asia, and now in Central Europe, or sort of UK, basically, in the northeast of England, in a working class environment. And she basically says, not to spoil the podcast entirely, but basically that we were the worst ones in terms of helping, which for a variety of different cultural reasons. So it's a very like sort of philosophical podcast and very debatey. But that's one of the reasons I love doing this, because it's essentially talking about something really important, and something as important as well-being and health, and what makes you happy, I guess, really should be the if this was a hosted episode, that's what I would call it, what makes us happy. And I think it was a really, really fantastic discussion. It was a wonderful place, the Back to Balance Centre. If you want to know more information, it's back -2-balance.co.uk. If you want to check out their website with some recommendations and all that, and all the stuff that they offer. But Nikki was a hugely great guest. She was also on Mentally Sound, the last one that's been released in March. So check that out as well. But fantastic interviewer. Me and Ricky had a really great time. So this is the episode with Nikki Robertson. Enjoy. The problem with this, so we are recording from now, the problem with this is I always don't know how to start these things, so I was just like kind of like, because we've just been, it makes it sound like we haven't been talking, and we're just like, right, until the microphones get turned on, we're just in silence the whole time. So I'll say, from this point on, we are here at Back to Balance with Nikki, who's been on our other show, Mentally Sound, which is a mental health show, and we are here in the marvelous, is it called, technically West, did you say it was West, where is this actually based?
West End is like huge, but yeah, it's technically, so it's like in between, you've got Throckley that's down there, mm-hmm. Yeah, Scotswood. So yeah,
we're right in between Scotswood and Newcastle.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Technically this is called Newcastle Business Park.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot bigger than most people think it is. And we're right in the middle of the two, aren't we?
Yeah, and we are literally, and just to convey a good for radio purposes, we are literally 10 metres away, or something like that, maybe 20 metres away from the river, the wonderful River Tyne. And I guess basically, so as we said, Nicky was on our Mentally Sound, so the idea is he's wanted to come to see this marvellous office. And I think the first question is, because we said this on the way here, because the context is, we saw these units of places and went, we wonder what's down, we wonder what's down there. I did not realise it.
I was going to say, how do you ever get any work
done? Yeah, well that's exactly it. How do you get any work done? Because we're in your office.
And it's a more serene place.
So how do you react to the view? Have you got used to it? Because you've been here like 18 months, did you say?
So we've been here 18 months. And initially, it was very distracting for me. You know, especially when you're working with clients, because when they come in, they get really distracted. Mm-hmm. And not in a negative way. That distraction's great because it really calms all their senses down.
That's what I mean. It works in their favor, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Like I've said before, it adds so much value to the therapy. But I would find myself as well getting lost with the water as well, because, you know, it's beautiful. You get the bird life. It's just stunning. Mm. But it actually adds so much peace to myself, you know, and to the therapists who work here. When you're working and you've got that view, it adds that quality and that therapy for yourself, so you can center yourself better, you know. And being a therapist is all about really being centered within yourself, so that you can create that bubble or that environment for your clients. So it's wonderful. When, you know, when we're doing therapies, it's fantastic to be working out of this office. When I'm doing admin work, I find, because, you know, there's obviously the other side of doing the therapies as well. There's quite a bit of admin. I find if I'm, you know, head down too long, it's great. I just step away from my desk, sit down in, you know, the couches, and just sit and just take a couple of breaths, take a breather, and just sit there and... release all that tension that's building up. It's brilliant.
At least it's not like it's got like, because it's a bit like sort of a muddy area before you get to the river around here, because I think if that was like a perfect like sand orientated thing, I could see it just be like, let's just all go on sunbathe. Let's forget this whole business thing. It's just
but the other nice thing is that it's such a lovely walk as well.
Yeah,
you know, it's a really long walk, and
I mean,
it's something we advocate all the time.
Yeah,
take a pause, get out of the workspace and just go for a walk. And what a better place.
Well, I was just saying, because I don't live too far away from here, and you know, I'm really getting into my running, and it's really important for my well-being. And I'm really seriously thinking about how am I going to like, just like, you know, just to run and just because I can really feel inspired.
You'll see, I mean, you may not see it now, but in a little bit, you'll see people running up and down.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even in the cold days, that always intrigues me, because obviously I don't come from a really cold country.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you see it's cold outside, it's like 1 or 2 degrees. People are still running, and I'm always amazed and inspired at, you know, what drives them to run in that temperature.
Yeah. Well, I guess though it's a bit like, I mean, I know, you know, I've got two dogs, and I always like find that you still have to get into the mindset of, because it's, you know, I know, because as I say, being that you've been on Mentally Sound, you've mentioned well-being for running, is that you find that you still have to get into the, I still want to get into the mindset of, because I know it's good for the dogs, is to still take them out no matter what the weather is. Because I guess, and I know being that you're, the work that you do, that we can, I'm sure you could talk about it in a more detailed sense of routine. Is good for human beings, you know, to keep up with something, because they get, you know, I find, you know, as people listen to this podcast know, with having bipolar, I have a very chaotic mind a lot of the time, and a lot of thoughts all at once. So the idea of doing something consistent keeps my mind kind of sharp and focused in a kind of good way. So I think that's probably why people run regardless of the weather, because they just think they must see. I'm guessing they must see the value of doing it.
Yeah. If you remember, remember Peter, the mindful runner.
Yeah, I follow him on Instagram.
He's an amazing guy, because one of the questions I asked him on the show was like, because obviously the studio is in a very urban environment. How would someone like, if I was to jog around there, how would one get mindfulness? And he showed us how to do it. So you can do it when you're in the zone. It doesn't matter what your surroundings are. But obviously, if you have a setting like this, you're at an advantage.
When I was living in Malaysia, I used to go to the Buddhist centre. There was a Buddhist centre right in the middle of town.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, Kuala Lumpur is a hectic city.
Yeah.
Peak hour traffic can last for about 3 hours. You know, it can take you an hour and a half just to get to drive less than 20 miles, you know. And I remember a couple of times the monk would take us out in the evening in peak hour traffic and make us do a mindful walk.
Yeah.
Wow. And really learn to not get distracted by, you know, the scooters and the people and buses and the cars and all the tooting and all of that distraction. And that was really, really valuable. And, and I guess what Peter's doing is something exactly like that. Is, you know, when not everyone can run along such a scenic and calm route like this.
Yeah.
So how do you create that stillness and that calmness and not get constantly distracted? Because, again, you're doing it for a reason, aren't you?
Well, he actually is called, just for context, because I don't know if you met Peter before, but he's called Mindful Runner.
It is literally
you know, a mindful, you know, he came up with the idea of, because his company is
He lost his job.
Yeah.
And then he couldn't afford bus fare home, so he just ran home.
That's right,
And he got the idea whilst running home that I could really do something.
Yeah.
And isn't his business named after his family name, isn't it, I think?
Maguire Running
or something, yeah, which is surname or something, yeah, because he basically, I think all his family do it or something now, and it's a kind of like a bonding thing as well.
Would you have to do that, what you were talking about before, if someone like a bulldozer came here and took this space?
Why are you ruining
it? No, I don't need to, because I'm intrigued, and you were to plonk it in the middle of town. Gathering mind where you have all that sort of traffic going on.
Oh, that's a good question.
How would you use the same adapting sort of methods, you know, mindfulness within your work? So, like, people come see you. Do you see what I mean here? So it's not just...
Like location, I think. Yeah, I get your point, yeah.
So to create the calmness in the environment, or to create the calmness within the person? Yeah, I do believe you can.
Okay.
And I think... So, you know, I've got quite a strong spiritual practice. So for me, it's really about the energy that you cultivate for yourself.
Yeah.
And that really exudes into the space that you're in.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that, and we know this, you know, when we go and look at houses or apartments or things like that, you walk into a place and it's empty technically because the person's not there. It's just the belongings which are there. And you walk in and you just get the feel that it's right or the feel that it's wrong. So that's about the energy. So energy settles. And whatever energy you're creating and cultivating will settle in that space.
Yeah.
So if you're in quite a frantic state of mind and you're in a room, someone will walk in the room and feel that. So that's quite important then to kind of change that space. So you can create a calmness wherever
it's like
you're at.
There's a, you know, Leeser's Park, which is like a little park next to the football stadium.
Seen that, yeah.
And I used to walk by there to my counselling. But every time I used to walk through there, there was all these like workers who were on their lunch break sitting around this lake. And it's amazing that the trees can actually block out a lot of the traffic.
Exactly,
And you do get a feeling of serenity. Yeah. So I always love walking through that.
Serenity is a terrible film.
Terrible
is not the word. We'll get to that later.
I'm reserving my judgment. Yes.
Anyone, that's a call back to the previous podcast.
So in your space, you know, if you're sitting in the centre of the city centre and it's really noisy, you would look at soft furnishings. You know, because they absorb sound. You would look at the decoration of your space.
Interesting.
Colours. We know this. Colours affect our moods. Scents affects our moods. So the smells that you bring into the place, all things like that, can change the environment you're in.
Are you saying then hard furniture would then echo sound, like sound bounces off that, so you wouldn't get that then? I'm just interested in that.
No, furniture will actually... So if we had to take all the furniture out of this room, you won't have the same sound or the same feeling in the room. So furniture, if you start adding carpets and couches and even tables, they will all help to absorb the sound.
I see. Okay.
And that's always really important when you're looking at soundproofing in rooms and things. Mm-hmm. You know, when you walk in a room, you think, is this going to be good enough, you know, for a therapy center? And they always say, don't forget, you still need to put your furniture in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a wall hanging even, you know, some tapestry, something.
Yeah, you were making me think, actually, I mean, again, this shows how open this conversation is, because you were making me think about, because my partner is a big fan of, and I know my sister is too, of that, is it the Japanese woman who does tidying? Have you heard about it? It's Maria, her name Maria, something, yeah. Mira or something.
I've noticed she's divided a lot of opinions.
Yes, but the reason I wanted to ask you, because I think it's related to what we're talking about, because you were saying about, like furniture has an impact, and you were talking about just general things in general. But I find, like, for example, one of the things that she says, like, so she takes different things in your house that you see every day and goes and basically says that if you have this feeling about something, you should do something about that feeling. And so the particular example I wanted to mention was clothes, because she said if you have loads of clothes that you look at and you find that you don't wear, you should psychologically get rid of them, because they're literally like a mess in your own house, and it's a mess in your own head, because you keep, you know, you're even if you're not aware of it, it's psychologically having an impact on that. And considering this is something in your profession, I imagine you see all the time, you know, in terms of just sort of decluttering their life, not just that brain. So I'm interested to talk to you about are there other examples of that, and how important, how much of an effect does that really have on a person, in your opinion?
I run a stress management and relaxation course.
Great.
And that's one of the things that we look at. So one of them is decluttering. Mm-hmm. So important, because a lot of the stuff that we're hoarding or holding on to doesn't really serve us anymore.
Yeah.
So we're constantly evolving as people. You know, if you think about where you are today, so 21st of March, think last year, 21st of March, physically you may still be the same person.
Yeah.
But emotionally, mentally, in terms of self-development, you're very different to what you were. The growth that you've had in a year is so intense, and this happens all the time. Mm-hmm. So why would something that we've had for the last 15, 20 years still be serving us? And if it is serving us, it won't be serving us on the same level. Mm-hmm. So I do believe that it's really important to declutter. Yeah. The other thing is that, you know, especially if you're looking at your wardrobe, something that you've had, you know, my favorite top that I've kept for the last 15 years might not still be your favorite top. You've programmed yourself to believe that it's your favorite top. So it's, you know, we're in a world where we don't feel as good as we should. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stress happening in our lives. And why are we surrounding ourselves with things that don't add that value to make us feel good about ourselves when we're constantly getting the message that we're not good enough or not important enough? So I think decluttering so that you only hold space for what does make you feel good.
Yeah.
And, you know, wearing it or feeling it or having it around you really uplifts you.
I think there's several things there for me. It's like materialism, for one thing, really puts me off because of the reasons that I just don't feel it. It's
external.
I don't feel fulfilled by all that.
It's external. Yeah. I find with materialism, feel free to add your own point. I find with materialism is that it's an external, almost like approval from somebody else. It's less about what value you assign to that. Mm. Because I've seen people go, like, if you actually sit down with somebody, I think my partner would be okay in saying, like, and I've done it before, where you see something, like, and this is where advertising comes into an effect, like the psychological impact that advertising
very clever.
Has.
Advertising's very clever, you know.
Well, look at perfume. Perfume and deodorant adverts is all about lifestyle, isn't it? They do advertising about lifestyle to basically say to you, the illusion of that you're going to become Ewan McGregor, for example, in overnight if you wear this deodorant.
Charlize Theron.
But the whole point is, it's selling a lifestyle and a choice, because and I find myself afterwards going, it makes sense, because psychologically what they're trying to tell you is you can't live without this thing.
Yeah.
When actually, if you take a step back, you realise it is absolutely meaningless, really.
In this sort of capitalist sort of culture that we're in, we're always like, you know, encouraged to spend more, and therefore you're going to be more sort of healthy, wealthy and everything. But it's almost like I've travelled in another direction. I mean, my family are quite materialistic, but I always feel uncomfortable in some of their surroundings, because I've always gone the other direction where I feel like less is more.
Yeah.
I feel more encouraged, more self-aware when I'm surrounded by less things, as in, you know, I don't need much of the things that...
It's quite interesting when, you know, we look at self-development and trying to balance the personality so that the person can you know, connect with their self-esteem and their self-confidence. And you'll find, you know, in the beginning stages, they do tend to surround themselves with things because it's a barrier. It's them hiding away from the emotional side that they don't want to face, or, you know, the lowness within their own emotional self. And then as they start to connect to their inner strength and their inner power, you'll find that they suddenly start to connect to the fact that, hang on, I don't need this item. So that's all about attachments, isn't it? We place our sense of identity, our sense of self-worth, and what's my purpose in life on whether I have the latest whatever phone or driving the latest model car, you know, that's just come out, that, you know, society's telling me that if I've got that car, then I've made it in life. So once they start to self-actualize, you'll see that they don't attach themselves to those ideals anymore.
Yeah.
And if they have it, it's because it's a choice. They've chosen to have that item because they want to have that item. It doesn't make them feel better about themselves. It's about the fact
it's
that
separate
actually,
to that. Yeah.
Yes, I enjoy having this item.
But it isn't like the be all and end.
It doesn't make me have a value in life. Yeah. I have my value in life. I am.
Do you think that's the same principle? Because there's a few thoughts. I know you said about a few thoughts, so feel free to come back to that. But I was thinking about, as you said that, do you think there's a comparison as well? Like, I think what we're basically talking about is having, like I said about external with materialism, like external happiness is that I find people sometimes do that in relationships, is that they rely on the other partner to make them happy. Is that another example of what we were talking about here? Like kind of just putting an external view on themselves, like putting their self-esteem and all that other stuff into an outward thing.
So when we place our sense of identity or our sense of purpose or our sense of value on a person, place or thing, so when we place it externally, then the internal drive, the internal factor will always be depleted. And that will always be empty. You can layer it up with whatever. You can layer it up with whatever you want to. Right?
Yeah.
All these external factors. Essentially, the internal core remains empty. So there we talk about the illusion again, because we're layering it up externally. We're telling ourselves, we're creating this dialogue within our mind saying, if I have this, I'll be happy. If I have this, I'll be happy. If I have that, I'm going to be happy. But essentially, the person doesn't really feel happy. And then they start to question, why am I not happy? I've got all these things. My life is great. This is going well for me. You know, they start rattling these things. Why am I not happy in life? It's because they never went to the core and the foundation and made themselves be happy. They're just, I am.
For themselves.
That simple, I am.
How much of it boils down to culture as well? And I'm speaking from a personal point of view. So this sort of Anglo-Indian sort of like surroundings I've been brought up in, I've always felt that there was almost like a pressure that you were judged upon on the very things you said before, like having the latest car, the biggest house. And like, and when I've just sort of given an indication of who I am before. So for me to fit in that kind of surrounding was just like, you know, it's like fitting square pegs in round holes. It just was never going to work.
Yeah.
So how much of it does stem from culture, from like people that
I
you see?
I do think a lot. Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know that I spent 12 years in Asia. So I hope I'm not offending anyone when I say, you know, if you look at the Chinese culture and the Indian culture, you know, status was quite important. So, you know, what you were studying was really important.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know if we've mentioned it before, but, you know, looking at being an artist wasn't seen as being successful.
Tell me about it.
You know, being a doctor or a lawyer or, you know, an accountant, these were things which they based their success
like
on.
Social status, isn't
yeah,
it?
That's social social status. Yeah. So culture does play a massive, massive role in people's mindsets. And if you're breaking the trend that you chose
like
to do,
yeah,
or you're trying to.
I'm the rebel.
Well, you're choosing to, so we don't try anything. We choose them. So that becomes quite difficult because you're then not only fighting with what everyone else is telling you, but you're fighting within this internal program that you would learn from a child. So if you think about that program, it's kind of ticking over 24/7, you know, your entire life, and it starts off as young as maybe a year old or 18 months old, and it takes you right up until this very moment now, and that's constantly going on in your head. So it's like that subliminal message right?
Yeah.
And now you're saying, I want to be different to that. Mm-hmm. So if you can imagine this push-pull, like this tug-of-war, but yeah. sometimes it's not as pretty as the tug-of-war, because tug-of-war can be fun at times, isn't
yeah.
it? But this is a nasty tug-of-war, because you know what you want to do for yourself, but you've got such a strong belief system that's come through for you, and a program that's come through for you that's saying, you cannot be that, because you will not achieve in life, or you know, you're not going to be successful in life. And that's where this mental anguish starts to come in. Mm-hmm. And this fight within yourself, you know, and then you start to maybe even lose your drive for it. Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like, I mean, that was a very good, complicated, and good view of it. But I think the sort of basic way to define it is to say it's your expectations versus the expectations of others.
Yeah.
And I think what, as you quite rightly said, you know, very eloquently, is I think, As you were talking there, I was thinking, I think that applies to so many different people, and it's so dangerous.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking there, you were talking about culture, and I mean, obviously I'm from a working class family in Wall's End, which is not too far from here. And I found myself going, like, you know, because, I mean, this podcast is a good example of who I am as a person, because, you know, it's called Geekapocalypse. I've always been, like, sort of a geek and a nerd, or in a sort of stereotypical sense, but, I mean, basically all it means is to be passionate and interested in something, to be geeky, to be geeky about anything, you know, like, it can be, I mean, I always do say the example of that I once had a guest on who spent 30 minutes talking about horse riding, because it was the thing she ran a singing company, so she taught people how to sing. But she said, like, my main passion is not even that. My main passion is, like, I always, like, go, even though I love my job, and it is a job, and I sing in my own, I was singing in a band and everything, my favourite thing to do is to go to my, like, little farm where I have a horse and do horse riding. So she talked about that for, like, half an hour, because that was her passion.
What about the other comparison we made? Like, so I go to the football match every weekend.
Yeah.
That's 50,000 geeks of a different...
Yeah, being geeky about that team.
And dress up in black and white and,
well,
you know...
It's people who
it's labels, isn't it?
Yeah, which
labels,
it doesn't need to be labelled.
Geek shouldn't have... It shouldn't just fall under the tech...
Yeah.
The tech label.
Of course not.
Because you, like you said, you know, footballers aren't going to consider themselves geeks, aren't they?
No.
Because it's, you know,
it's sort of a man of culture.
Because it's always associated with more, like, sort of, minority stuff that's like, niche stuff, basically. Whereas obviously 50,000 people will be like, well, I'm part of a big, and obviously there could be millions of fans of a football team, but I don't think it is about quantity of people who like it. It's just whatever you're interested in, that's what should matter.
I think the crux as well of what we were saying before, it's just I've always believed in the power of the individual. I've never, you know, if you're in a surroundings, you're in a culture, I've always felt, well, at least judge me on who I am, please look inside rather than what I'm surrounded by. And that's always the tide I've always tried to fight
how
against.
How many people take the time?
That's what I was going to get at,
How many people
do you mean to learn about the individual?
How many of us judge a book by cover? How many people
take
the time?
We
all are. I mean, if we want to truly be honest with ourselves, and that's really how you work on yourself, you know, the personal development and how you understand what's going on emotionally within yourself, is to develop that honesty and what I call emotional nakedness. Because you get into quite a vulnerable state with yourself.
Of course,
and you've got to recognize the stuff in you that you don't like. And we do, you know, even though some of us are a little bit more aware of other than others, and we'll recognize that we just judge someone and then try and take a pause from that and go into giving them some space. But we judge a book by its cover. It's a reflex.
It's like that guilty by association type thing, isn't it? It's like, please don't judge me for what others have done, just because we have to come from the same place, or at least, you know, live near one each other, or the family, or whatever, and
I mean, there's pros and cons to a lot of things, but another example of that that I think is kind of getting dangerous as well, I mean, obviously we'll get onto other things, but I find social media does that too, because I think it reinforces that very thing of, because I think people don't even get as far as judging a book by its cover. I think people put I call it putting them into convenient boxes.
Yeah.
So they'll basically tick a box to say, like, you're this, you're that, like labels, like we were talking yeah. earlier, is that like, they'll go, oh, he's bipolar, he's got this, he's that, he's trouble, he's not worth listening to. So if you hear, like, a rumour about a person, like, I saw this horrible thing and it turned out to be completely true. For example, me and my partner watched a police thing, and a guy got accused of being a paedophile. By a community because he was taking a photo near a school, and so all these people started to go like, "Yo, he's clearly a paedophile." And the point of the episode was is the police.
Did they chase him in a phone box?
Yes, that's right. Did you see it? Oh, right. Okay. So yeah, he gets put in a police box, and they basically say we're civil arrest. What's it called? Civil arresting.
Citizens arrest. He was trapped in a phone box,
yeah.
And they wanted to make a citizens arrest.
Yeah. So then the police guy turned up with a police dog, and he basically went, "What's going on?" So they said, "Oh, he was caught thinging photos." They looked into it. They searched his phone, had no pictures on his phone, absolutely nothing. And then they looked into it and found that he's been accused for about a month, and it's all down to like a couple of people who ultimately don't like him, and the whole entire community's turned on him, yeah. and he's dead fear for his safety.
That like picket fence mentality, yeah. isn't it? You know, like the witch hunts. I'm talking yeah. about like the yeah. witch hunts where they would go on a witch hunt, and
yeah.
no one even knew why. Then, yeah. if they really looked at what they were doing, they would understand that most people are innocent. But it's just this collective. You know, I don't like this person, therefore I mustn't like this person because I need to be part. I need to be accepted by the group. And it's quite sad that people don't.
Mob mentality.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And that's just, you know, again, not judge, you know, you're judging a book by its cover, you're not collecting all the information.
Yeah, exactly. I was about to say that. Yeah, it's not collecting information.
If anything, that guy who you mentioned, he was just a very vulnerable person. He just didn't seem to.
They said, the police guy said he didn't have a lot of, like, friends or people around that area.
He was a very
socially
isolated
like
kind
yeah.
of person.
And obviously that's made 10 times
people
worse.
People like that are kind of looked down you know, upon, aren't they? Like, oh, they must yeah. have something weird underneath going on that should be, you know.
Yeah, and you found, like, I'm glad you said about that, like, not looking into information, because again, like I touched on about talking about social mm. media, we become lazy. Mm. We become lazy as in, like, we get all this, like, you know what I mean? Because there's pros and cons to everything. Like I said, social media can't be very, very good.
We talk
yeah.
about that.
Like,
know?
Just having a sentence or something and just saying, like, okay, I've assigned that I know something now, like, because I've just been told to
basically,
have that
anyone who's got a smartphone now
yeah.
and can take pictures, obviously, we're all, like, photojournalists now. We can sort of invent anything and post it, and therefore yeah. it's gospel, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. and people go, you know, abide by that, you know, yeah. without doing the research and necessary work behind it.
Mm-hmm. So, I think what's nice to talk about now, because yeah, so we just talked about some random stuff there, is like, I mean, because we're obviously talking about, and you've clearly got an interest in this field, and obviously do it as a job and all that kind of thing, but I'm curious about sort of where that interest stemmed from, as in, like, you know, were you always somebody growing up, because I'm fascinated by human beings, and the reason I love having conversations with people is you start figuring out why people tick, and I obviously don't do that necessarily as like a sort of job per se other than interviewing people. But where did that come from? Was it like sort of early in life? Were you like always sort of curious kid and all that sort of stuff? Like, I'm yeah. curious about why, how that happened.
So I'm one of those people that I think was born passionate about what I do. So mm-hmm. my passion started from as young as I could remember. Mm-hmm. So from really young, you know, I remember my mom always used to buy magazines. That was her Friday night pastime. She would page through these magazines, and I would go and page through the pages and pull out.
We're not having champagne, by the way. Yeah. This is going so well.
We're being treated well here. Yeah.
So I would go through and pull out articles. So, you know, I was about 7 years old, 8 years old, and I used to have the suitcase under my bed, and I'd stack all the articles on health and exercise, nutrition, yeah. You know, homemade products, just tips on improving yourself, and I started from a really young age.
Yeah.
So I can safely say that I was born that way, because yeah. why would a 7 or 8 year old start doing something like that? Mm-hmm. It wasn't something that was brought down through the family tree. And growing up, you know, school wasn't easy. You know, I always felt kind of like I was the outcast, and home life wasn't easy for me. and I knew that there was stuff going on within me, and I had to try and figure out how to balance that out for me.
So was this in South Africa?
This was in South Africa. Yeah. And obviously there was lots of stuff happening just environmentally around us in South Africa. You know, the environment wasn't safe, and there were things which happened in, you know, to our families, which obviously caused a lot of stress and trauma for us. So that just made me really aware of how that was affecting myself, really.
Did you say politically as well?
Really in terms of crime rate. Just things, you know.
Yeah, it's one of the worst. It's one of the worst for crimes and all that sort of stuff. But where in South Africa?
Johannesburg.
So
in those days it was
Joburg.
Yeah. So in those days, I mean, Joburg was like the crime capital of the world, wasn't it? So, and that really just made me aware of the impact it was having on me and how I was feeling, you know, how unsafe I was feeling, you know, just within my environments all the time. And I knew that I wanted to study, you know, health. I knew I wanted to go into healing people and looking after their wellness. And I did that. Not that we look at culture. I come from a really staunch Sicilian family. Mm-hmm. My father's the matriarch of the family who doesn't believe that women are allowed to be educated.
Okay,
so, you know, we should be married.
Sorry, Dad.
We should be married by the time you're 21 and have your children and stay at home. And I obviously broke every rule. So, you know, if I talk about the proverbial black sheep of the family. I was really the proverbial black sheep of the family. So I enrolled myself into tertiary education without my parents even knowing about it.
So you really are, you really do practice what you preach, or the other way around in a sense.
I knew what I was passionate about, and I knew what I wanted to do, and even though I was being constantly told I couldn't do it, I refused to listen to it.
Yeah.
So I took the risks which I felt were essential, because I knew that if I went down the path which was set out for me by my, you know, my family, particularly my dad, I knew that I was going to be miserable in life. And, you know, already growing up, you know, going through teenagehood, you know, puberty, that was hard enough. And I thought, I refuse to spend the rest of my life like this.
Yeah.
And I know that I can take control of the situation. And for me, control is a really big thing, you know, being in control of the situation and connecting to the fact that you can choose how you want to experience the situation.
Absolutely. So really important. Yeah.
I went and I studied for 3 years against the family's wishes or my dad's wishes, and then started my practice in South Africa.
Yeah.
And I specialised in the reflexology and the body therapies. And in those days, you know, in South Africa is quite progressive with the alternative therapies. We were under the medical banner. We worked with doctors. You know, doctors would call us into hospitals to work with patients in hospitals. We would work with the fertility clinics. So you really had the respect of the doctors. But it also meant that you had to keep it quite clinical in that sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I could see already that there was this whole emotional side that was stopping people from really finding that wellness within themselves. Mm-hmm. And part of one of the subjects when we studied was psychology. So, you have that basis, and you can see where people are getting stuck, but you couldn't quite go into it. So when my husband and I made the decision to move to Asia, I decided to really break free. So again, you know, I try not to be confined by what I'm allowed to do and what I'm not allowed to do. And I take those risks.
Yeah.
So when I moved to Asia, I knew that I had the ability to really work on the level that I wanted to work. And that was the holistic level.
Yeah.
You know, where you're looking at body, mind, and soul. So the minute I started my practice back in Asia, that's how I started. And it took a while because some people were like, but I just wanted to come for a massage. I don't really want to understand what's going on within me that's causing the pain. And I just set it up that that's how I worked. And that was what I was really passionate about, is trying to get to the source of what was going on for the person and creating those protocols, or just educating them about what was going on. You know, your back pain is a little bit more than just your back pain.
Yeah.
That is the symptom. That's a physical symptom of something that probably started a long time ago.
Yeah.
But that quickly caught on, you know, because no one, you've got to think that was, I've been here almost 6 years, I've worked in Asia for 12 years. So in those days, no one was looking at the whole body, mind, spirit, like combining it under one umbrella. And that picked up really quickly. And a lot of clients, when I left Asia, like, what are we going to do now? But they've all found someone, you know. And I do work internationally. A lot of them still have stuck with me. And I do work internationally with them.
So was that Malaysia?
That was Malaysia, yeah. So, and that was really my passion, was this holistic wellness. It's really to find out what is really going on here, you know. I don't want to treat a symptom, because treating a symptom is just kind of like putting a plaster over a sore that's festering. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to really treat the sore properly. Mm-hmm. And that's what I try and do with everyone. You know, delve deep.
I mean, there's so many things to ask there. Look, Rick, I'm sure whenever you want to ask something, Ricky, feel free. There's so many things to ask in relation to that. I guess the first of all, because you mean you've obviously been doing this for a while based on that answer. And I'm just curious as to go, because I find that your passion that you've just described, I think is very problematic even now, in the sense of, it's problematic in the sense of, I think that's the thing that we need to sort of teach people even now, particularly in England, because obviously I know you've got three different examples. I mean, there's been two other different cultures and in countries. And I think here, the one thing which is why it took me till, like, I'm now 31 and I feel like the happiest I've ever been, and I think it was sort of like I would joke that my 20s was kind of like my building the blocks for me to be happy for the rest of my life kind of thing, because me, you know, and I think it is down to sort of the emotional side, which is the long-term recovery we just don't deal with now. And I'm guessing what the thing I wanted to ask you is, if you've been doing this for a while, do you feel that there's been, obviously there'll be, I'm assuming you, in your field and your work and your company and everything, that there's been progress, but how do you feel, and maybe compare the cultures, do you feel like it's different in, was it different in Asia to here, or are we all the same, or like how
can I just
it?
Ask one question on the end of that?
Yeah.
I just want to know, in your experience with Asia, do you think that they're more progressive in terms of how we deal with things here?
Culturally, they are more open to alternative therapies, because if you think about, you know, if you look at, like the Indians would have Ayurveda, you know, so they are really going into alternative therapies. Yeah. The Chinese have the traditional Chinese herbal medicine and acupuncture. So traditionally, they are open to looking at alternatives. And they do recognize that there is a little bit more than just the physical, because obviously the alternative therapists or the alternative therapies focus on a more holistic approach. So if you look at cultures, and even in South Africa, culturally, they were more open to delving a little bit deeper into the person and blending the therapies. Coming here, that was also something interesting that I had to learn to kind of adjust to, because, you know, move to England, you know, first world country. And I thought, brilliant, you know, this will be easy just to make that transition. And I've noticed that it's not as easy. People are not as open to looking at the different selves. You know, they'll want to just focus on one part of themselves.
Do you think there was more of a quick fix type sort of thing going on here?
Mentality.
Yeah, and sort of like, you know, here's a prescription for some meds rather than, you know, potentially looking at other areas which might be more beneficial.
Yeah, I do think so. I do think that it's very much, let's put the plaster on it.
Yeah.
And if I, you know, if I have the prescription, then I'll feel better. But the problem is that they're not getting better. You know, often, you know, we'll see people in clinic who, just the other week, I saw someone who had been on painkillers for a month and her problem wasn't getting better. And I was like, we've got to get to the bottom of this. Can we please look at another avenue for you? You know, as much as I love seeing my clients, I don't want to be a fix for them. I want to get to the bottom of what's going on. And she sat with that for a while, and then she came back in and she said, right, I'm happy to look at something else. And I'm like, great, let's devise a program for you so that we can actually get to the bottom of what's going on. You can't live on medication.
Yeah, do you think as well, I mean, as I say, there's a number of different avenues we can talk about here, but it actually goes full circle to what we were talking about earlier, because you were saying about, like, I find people end up in situations like you were describing earlier that follow the same pattern of trying to get better, and or someone tells them that like this is the road that you need to go down on in a kind of clinical way, like you were saying earlier. And I think I'm a good example of this because I have an emotional disorder. So I find like, you know, the clinical stuff would only ever get me so far. It might make my symptoms better for a little bit of time, but it wasn't getting to the cause, like you were saying, of what my problem is. And I just think, and I wanted to ask you this directly, in your experience with all the clients you deal with, is that do you find that people don't give themselves enough of a break? Because I think that, to delve in what I mean by that, is that you were saying that, like, a lot of the time, like, we were talking about decluttering, for example, and, like, I think too many people focus on things that they're not in control of, the things that, like, external stuff, like, we were talking about external stuff with materialism and getting likes on social media and all that sort of thing, stuff that has external happiness, and they wonder why they're not happy. But I find that they're focusing on things that are out of their control, and I'm curious to ask you, is that an element of fear? Are they fearful of, or are they just not aware of that they're like putting all their energy into things that actually isn't the cause of what's, do you get what I'm saying? Like the cause of their effect?
Because everyone's different, it could actually be both.
Yes.
You know, so, I think essentially awareness will always be one of the key issues, you know, if they are focusing on something or they're trying to achieve something that is unattainable, then it's understanding that for themselves, is developing that awareness. Again, you look, fear is a major driver for most of the decisions we make in life.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, we're so fearful of this outcome or ending up in this situation. Or let's talk about work. We're so fearful of not having a job or finding a job, so I'll rather stay in this job that makes me so unhappy. And is affecting me so badly at work that when I come home, I'm a shell of the person I should be. It's affecting my personal relationship with my family, affecting me on a social level. But I'm so afraid that I'm not going to find a job. I'll rather stay here.
Mm-hmm. So it's the fear. Is it like a fear of the unknown?
Yeah, or the fear of. I just think fear, because it could be the fear of the unknown or the fear of not being able to achieve what you want.
Yeah.
So,
but then the irony of that is they're not achieving what they want already.
So that's where the awareness comes in.
Yeah.
So when you start to look at, hang on a second, where you're at right now is really, really not working for you. Mm-hmm. If we look at the core pillars of what's keeping you healthy, all of those pillars, you know, either have cracks in them or are crumbling or have completely been knocked down. This fear then becomes the illusion, the fear of not having, you know, something to go to. That's the illusion that's keeping you stuck. Yeah. So rather confront the fear, push through that illusion, and take the necessary steps to find something that's going to get your pillars back into a balanced state.
I find this fascinating because, we all wish to have... You know, when we look at career, you know, job satisfaction, but of course not all of us get that. So do they have to find other means through other areas of life to remain mentally well, you know, have a mentally well-being kind of way of life? Do they have to look at other areas? Because of course when we talk about jobs, it's tough out there and we always can't get what we want.
Yes,
so
yes.
Do we have to look at other areas in our lives to make up for that then?
I think if you don't get what you want, I'll get to your question. If you don't get what you want, don't make it a permanent situation, because I really believe that you will be able to get what you want. Sometimes you have to use something as a stepping stone. What people do is they don't use it as a stepping stone.
Yeah.
They use it as, I'm stuck here, right? So at least I've got this. At least I know. And I completely get it. You know, we've all got bills to pay, and that becomes a priority. You know, that's an obligation. You know, you have to pay those bills. So, you know, it becomes a means to an end. But I do believe that if you can recalibrate your thought pattern and value what's going on within you, you know, are you essentially really happy? And if you can just find that courage to take the necessary steps, you know, while you've kind of just perched on that little stepping stone for that period of time, keep looking for something.
Yeah.
You know, keep the feelers out there. Something will come up. Mm-hmm. I do believe we've always got stepping stones in life. You know, we don't just move from one position to the next. You know, not everyone's able to do that.
Yeah.
I do believe that we have to go through some stepping stones, and sometimes we slide a little bit as we place our foot on that stepping stone. Mm. So then, if you're in a place that's not working for you, so let's say if it's your job, we spend how many hours a day in our jobs?
Mm-hmm.
The average person is spending what?
It's
40 hours a week.
40 hours a week.
Yeah,
like that. That's a big time, because that's more than home, and that's more than your social time, and that's more, you know, you spend more time there than your recreational time, your fun time, your family time, your downtime, where it's just your personal rest time.
Which is super, not where super you, important as well.
Yeah, not where you're kind of interacting with people, so it's your personal quiet time. So if you're expending a large amount of, let's say, negative energy in a place,
mm-hmm.
try and then pick up the energy in the other places. So make the time to try and, you know, almost like if you had to, like, pick up the volume on something, you know. What's it called? Your, like, the radio, you know.
Turn up the dial
in the other areas. Because what happens is that when we're spending so much time in a place that we're not enjoying, it drops our motivation, it drops our energy, it drops our personal drive, you know, and that affects everything else. So,
see, I think as well, like, you know, because again, I think throughout this sort of, it is sort of learning to be self-aware, I think, is kind of the biggest tool that you can have.
Yeah.
Because as you were talking there, I was thinking about, and as well as when Ricky was talking too, is that if you're in a job where you can, if you can find the self-awareness to say it's a stepping stone, I always think, again, it also, because of that, it reinforces being a little bit grateful, because I was thinking about, I find there's a lot more people who are in worse off positions, aren't even at that stage, because I think there's some people, particularly, I don't know whether you find this is a cultural thing in England, because I mean, I'm talking about my experience, and I mean, I've been to other countries, and I do think we have a weirder, like, sort of, because the thing I'm trying to say is about permission. I feel that sometimes you come across people who are going, like, they might have some optimism, internal optimism, to go, oh, the thing that I want, my dream job or my dream opportunity will come eventually, but they're not doing anything to reach that point. Like, they're sort of sitting at home. I used to say to my partner all the time, like, what would you like to do? Because we're obviously looking after our daughter at the minute. And I'm like, what do you want to do? Because we're at a crossroads now. We've had other careers and we're trying to think, you know, well, I'm still doing my career now, sort of. Yeah. But I just mean, we're like, and I'm kind of embracing it, because I'm going, I can do whatever I want. And it's just figuring out what I would like to do. And so my partner's like,
volunteering is underrated.
Yeah.
I've had so much opportunities and stuff come my way.
Yeah, it's finding, like you were talking about, it's finding the thing that makes you joyful or whatever it may be. But my point is, there are people who exist who I meet as well, who go, oh, I'll get my dream job, but eventually it'll just, like, as if it's going to be handed to them. So there are some situations where,
to get what you want in life, you need to put a certain amount of energy into it.
Yes.
So going back to the whole energy word again, you know, it's not, if your energy is stagnant in an area, then you're not going to attract anything to that, you know. You've got to start creating a movement in that, and then you'll find that opportunities will start coming your way. Mm-hmm. But it's about just vocalize.
Yeah.
You know, just the mere fact where you sit down with someone and say, you know, I'm thinking about changing my career. It's interesting how the minute you start to use your words on something,
because
this is where we actually self-actualize from the Mathra chakra.
Yeah.
So when we actually vocalize a goal, that energy is out there in the universe, and suddenly things start moving and shifting to line up to that. But you've got to start recognizing it for yourself. So the awareness for yourself, say it to someone, write it down, and start thinking, you know, how can I achieve what I want? Again, be realistic. You know, maybe it's going to take 2 or 3 more years before you can do that.
Yeah, Yeah, because I just think, like, because I know, I'm sure I've mentioned this to you when we've sat in the same room, and I definitely had a conversation with Ricky about this. Like, so I help out at the university on the social work course, and I was saying I had a conversation with Ricky about this when we sat down for a coffee and that, and I was saying that I was wondering why I wasn't feeling as good about being at the university, because I enjoy talking about being my mum's carer and talking about, like, my experiences of being with social workers. And it was a bit like what I said about you, like, writing the book. Well, now that I'm writing this book in my spare time, and I get such joy, like, talking to my partner about it and going, and, like, I've drawn characters of what, so I can think about what the character looks like while I'm writing about them, and Shonan, like, being so excited about it. But I'm saying about this self-awareness and saying, like, because what you said, I think, a good sort of advice for someone to sit and reflect and go, is it a stepping stone to what you want to do? And if it's not, you shouldn't do it, realistically. But I'm saying, like, I sat there and went, maybe I should stop doing the university stuff because I'm feeling less and less fulfilled about it. But then I realised that it's not that I don't enjoy doing it. I don't feel they're getting enough out of me. That's what I mean. I feel like I need to say more. I think I need to go, please use me more often.
I'm going through the very same thing at work right now.
You know, when you reach a point, like a plateau, where you go, you've been doing the same thing for a while. And I realised, because I just turn up to these things and I talk about my life and talk about helping my mum and talk about my own mental health struggles and stuff like that, because I'm confident and I've worked hard on myself to be the point where I can talk about it amongst 100 strangers I don't know in a big theatre. But I found I was saying the same story over and over again, and the reason I love doing these podcasts and talking to someone like yourself, Nikki, and obviously with Ricky, is that I want to delve into the more. I want to delve into Nick. I know I said on the way here, Nicky and Ricky. I said on the way here, it sounds like a comedy act, doesn't it? It's like, and Nicky, like from X Factor. Yeah. Hello, we're Nicky and Ricky.
I'll just say I want to change my career now. I can see something in comedy here.
Yeah. And we're going to sing.
I'm not singing.
I've got maracas, and Ricky's going to sing It's a Wonderful Life.
Can I give you a personal experience of mine?
Yeah, that would be wonderful.
One of my biggest dreams has been to, because, you know, I started meditation a long time ago, and my biggest dream has been to go to an ashram or go on a retreat somewhere. But for me, it's a silent one. I want to go to a silent retreat where you can, for 7 days, 10 days, just be in silence. And that's been something I've always wanted to do. And I started investigating it when I've got two sons, and they were quite young. I think they were about a year and 3 years old. Mm-hmm. And the point of a silent retreat is no communication, no phones. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for me, even though it's something I've always wanted to do, I knew that I couldn't step away from my home and step away from my children and not have any contact.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting.
No contact, not check in at home, not hi, you know, nothing like that. So I did speak to the organizer and say, look, I really want to do this. I'm really anxious about not having any communication with the children, you know. Could I maybe do it, you know, for 3 days? And she said, you're not ready. And I'm like, no, I am ready. I really, really want to do this. Mm-hmm. And she said, you're not ready. You need to maybe think about doing this when you're ready. As I said, it's something I've always wanted to do. Mm-hmm. My oldest son has just turned 14. My youngest is about to turn 12. Mm-hmm. I've still not done it. Does it mean that... So when we tell ourselves we want to do something and we don't action it...
Yep.
So I never got to the point where I reframed that dialogue in my mind. So my mind kept with the, you're not ready. Wait until the children are older. Mm-hmm. And that's the loop I got stuck in.
Yeah.
Wait until the children are older. Oh, wait until the children are older. Mm-hmm. So that's 11 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure if I go away from home, I mean, they love me and I love them. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they'll be like, yes, mum's gone.
And then you might get there and go, actually, this is a really good idea. It's like, it might just
once a month.
It might just be the getting there that's the problem,
So your mind does get stuck on the information that you receive. So whether you it's your responsibility to reframe that if there's something you want to want to have in your life, you want to achieve in your life. You know, so many people have always said, oh, you know, like my husband, he's always wanted to do an MBA. You know, when he was younger, he didn't have the opportunity. There just wasn't money in the family at that point in time for him to be able to do that.
Did you say MBA then?
So, you know, like, for work.
Oh, okay.
And he's always felt that that's...
Wait, you meant basketball?
No.
That's what I was thinking. That's business. Awesome.
You want him on your podcast?
Yeah.
For him, he's always felt that that's something he really needed for his progression in business. He doesn't. And he hasn't needed it.
Yeah.
You know, he's really progressed well. But for him, in his mind, he's always felt... And I've said to him... Look at where you're at. Look at what you've achieved.
Yeah.
You know, through your career. Did you really need it? In your mind, you keep saying to yourself, I've needed that. If I have this, I would get to where I want to go. So we've got to, you know, when we're looking at achieving things, you know, we've got to look, like I said, those little stumbling blocks that we have, or those little stepping stones that we have. You know, are we using it as a stepping stone?
Mm-hmm.
Are we getting stuck there, you know?
Yeah, interesting.
I was wondering that on that, because I knew from my Indian background those ashram thing, and it never really kind of plugged into me before, but now with everything going on, we all get anxious, you know, when our phone stops working and we get, you know, we panic, don't we? So, am I going to... This need to be off-grid seems more
absolutely
powerful now for me. Absolutely. It's like you feel that you need to do it.
And it requires energy.
Yeah.
It requires like a commitment to do it now because it's so hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
There's a crime novelist, I don't know the name because it was somebody who was talking about this in an interview, because it was Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's a scientist, and he was talking about... Because they said with all the stuff that you do, because he runs the Hayden Planetarium in New York, and he's always on podcasts, and he does Startup, which is a thing about science. He does Cosmos, which is the science program, and he writes books. And they were like, so how for example, do you find time to write books? And he says, well, again, it's the principle of if you have the commitment to find the time, you can find the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, so I have two young children. So the options are, do I get up 2 hours before everybody else does and do 2 hours in the morning? No, not really realistic because my boys are little. So they're going to distract me and I'm not really going to get any quality time. So the only real option I find that I have is I stay up 2 hours later than everybody else and get it done before I go to sleep.
Yeah.
And that's the only time that I have. And he says, like, so he then mentioned, for example, this crime novelist who he liked, who I'd have to say I never heard of, but he was like, she was like a prize winning, like really well known writer, and she would book into a hotel room for the last like 5 days of her writing a final draft, and just basically put into a hotel room and say to like her family, I'm sorry, but I've got to get this done, and would sit in a hotel room in complete silence, put the do not disturb sign in, and just went with 5 days.
If something is important to you and,
mm-hmm.
and you need to get it done, it's prioritizing yourself above the needs of everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And if other people don't understand that, that's really their responsibility.
Yeah.
Because you may not understand someone else's priorities.
Yeah.
In fact, we're not going to understand other people's priorities. You know, we can try and understand, but individually we are all different people. You know, we've got all the same emotions, but the way they, you know, the recipe of how they're put together is very different, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you can empathize.
Yeah.
But you will never really understand why that person is being driven by that particular thing. And I always am admired by people who put themselves first on that level.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of think to myself, that's so, you know, that's brilliant. Can I really do that? You know, can I really, you know, unplug 5 days? I think brilliant for her that she does that.
Absolutely. So we've got like a few minutes left with you, so like something like 5 minutes or so. So there's a couple of things I wanted to ask, because I always end on asking people about like what do you think about future stuff. But I wanted to ask, like, just kind of a little fun thing at the end is what I always like to do roughly, is to just ask, because I think this is really important with the work that you do, and obviously that we've had a wide-ranging conversation about, yeah. about, like, sort of about, you know, like, self-belief, and I hope people listening to this is going to have a night, as good of a vibe as us looking out at this viewpoint that we've been giving. Unfortunately, Nikki is away from her window, so we've just been sitting. I think this is one of the reasons I feel so therapeutic. I feel like, you know, I'm in, like, this sort of, like, there's some candles in this room. It's like this aura. There's an aura in this room.
Looking at Nikki, I've got these beautiful, like, I've been watching, like, Driftwood. Yeah. From one side to, like, pass through Nikki and then to the other side.
Yeah, I was thinking
you've seen the birds.
Yeah, I know, I was actually saying this to somebody. You might even hear it through the microphone that there was birds coming past at one
point.
You want
to do all your podcasts from here.
Yeah, I know, yeah, not just that.
Saying,
like, just sitting right
here. The very
first
time I talked about mental health on my mental health was on Radio 4, and it was actually done on a producer's kitchen table. Which, I went down to Bristol. I thought we were kind of coming into a studio, so I was all nervy.
Yeah.
And I just got took into a house. I was like, what's going on here? And it's just like they had a big kitchen table, not too dissimilar to this, but obviously bigger. And they had all the breakfast spreads laid out, but the windows were open. You hear the birds outside, and I just felt totally relaxed.
See, because what's nice as well, I was going to ask you, because you said you were nervous at the beginning, which you never talked about, and I don't think you've looked at your notes once. which is fine. Well, I hope that's okay,
because
I think it's been really good. I've really enjoyed it. It's kind of what I wanted to do, because I thought, having talked to you, because, you know, it's funny you talk about confinement, because, you know, I would say, and I mean, I'm sure you feel obviously pleased to say your opinion about this, but mentally sound, for example, because we do it on the radio, it has a certain level of confinement because we have to stick to the format of what a radio show is.
Yeah.
But in a way, again, that has its pros and cons, but I don't think it necessarily destroys the show too much because it keeps you more focused, it keeps it more defined. And it's a different challenge.
Keeps you on your
feet. Yeah, it's a different challenge where the reason I do this, because it's different and I can justify it being two separate shows. I hope it comes across that there's a hugely different tone
to
this.
Absolutely.
It's a lot more laid back and we can delve into things a lot more because I'm sure I find when I listen back to our shows, because obviously Nikki's, you know, a regular contributor to our show, is that when we listen back to the Mentally Sounds, because I edit them before I put them out, like if there's any, just like any fine tuning with the sound, I don't edit them, like I don't take stuff out, but I find that I sometimes listen to conversations, which is what we want to do on the show, and go, I wish they would have talked about that longer, that was an interesting conversation, but they've had to stop for ads or play a song or all that sort of thing. Mm. So that's why it's nice to talk about this in detail.
So we do occasionally towards the end of the show go over time delivery.
Yeah, sometimes I do, because fortunately enough that there's nobody on after us, so I kind of cheekily add an extra 10 minutes thinking, hoping that the ad people don't ring up the Spice FM going, you were 10 minutes late on the 2 o'clock call. But I wanted to just say, because I think this is super important, because we've talked about everything in a kind of like, you know, clinical and emotional sense, but I think the kind of nice stuff, because we talked about how beneficial it is, like, you know, I love doing this podcast and I've got that buzz when I've been talking during this, and the room obviously helps as well, and the company, and just really enjoying it. And I know that I'm going to feel great during today because of just like talking about all this sort of stuff. But I wanted to ask you, being the guest on the show, is to say, after all this sort of, particularly because you do a clinical, you know, and you talk to people about their problems and all that sort of stuff, how does Nikki de-stress?
Oh,
like what's fun? I guess I'm sort of asking in a roundabout way. What's fun for you?
So
easy, you just turn around and look.
Yeah. You go, just get out of the room. What are you doing?
Pretend you're not. So,
gets the lights out. You know, the glowing lights, like, isn't it?
So when I'm at work, I will sit on the couch like you guys are sitting, and just sit and watch the water.
Yeah,
great.
Or go for a walk.
Mm-hmm.
At home, on a personal level, my number one thing which I do every day is I wake up an hour earlier before the kids, and I spend that time in the morning doing my meditation, reading inspirational quotes for the day, or, you know, just readings, working in my journal, you know, working on affirmations, working on mantras. So that's my spiritual connection, and that's the number one. And then through the day, I just connect. I take pauses and connect to the breath. So that's the number one thing. Exercise, important. Mm-hmm. I find now that since starting Back to Balance, I have less time than I used to. Mm-hmm. So whereas before I would go, you know, and train for an hour, you know, a couple
maybe
of times
30
a week.
Minutes now.
So now it might only be 20 minutes.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But the movement for me has always been so important because, as you know, I'm big on energy. You know, I have that strong spiritual belief. So while you're working with people, you're also absorbing a lot of the energy.
Yeah.
So movement is so important to eliminate that.
It's like a Star Trek reference, you know, the beta, there's a beta zoids in a thing where you just, I mean, because we feel like that. I mean, I imagine because you do this all the time. So, I mean, we always think when we do Mentally Sound and listen to someone's story and, like, you know, because we've had people talking about suicide and all sort of stuff, you feel very, my partner notices it when I come home on Fridays. That's why I actually made sure I don't see my mum afterwards, because I was going to my mum afterwards and then I was in such a like understandably quite not dark place but a very like negative very low, like, and I was like just going, I can't do anything because I feel so drained.
You need to disconnect from it. You need to learn to disconnect
which I just say to her, like, I just usually, like, maybe just going to the bedroom and just like being in a quiet room for a bit, just de-stress, like declutter.
But the good feeling does eventually still come though.
You
reflect and you think
But I'm now, that's how you feel, I imagine, doing your job. Do you feel like, you know,
because
when you de-stress, you go,
because I love my job, I don't feel stressed by it.
Yeah.
Of course, obviously, when some stories are hard to hear, but I've been doing it for 23 years, so you learn how to, you know, decompress after that, and you learn how to compartmentalize. And so that's why the meditation, the movement is so important, the journaling is so important for me. I do take time for self-care. I'll go for therapies, I'll go for massages. I mean, I'm lucky I work in a center, so we can, you know, trade off treatments with each other.
Nice.
I'll go out somewhere else and have a different treatment.
Cool.
So self-care is really important because I have to look after myself, otherwise I cannot provide for anyone else. Sleep routine is
even
so
therapists
important.
Need therapy.
In fact, you need to look after that. That's really important. I work with the remedies for myself because they balance on the emotional level. So I'm always.
I was going to ask you what that was because it was it was open.
So sleep routine is really important, and for me, quiet. I have to. I know what keeps me balanced, and I cannot go from a busy work week into a busy weekend week. And a lot of people think I'm very, like, very extrovert, sociable person.
I'm laughing because that's what I get all the time, and
I'm quite an introvert.
I am. I think Ricky can say that.
Yeah.
Would you say that?
Yeah.
I don't think I'm extroverted, as people say I am. And Ricky's been around people enough where I get the stereotype of, because I think you come across as you're introverted.
Yeah.
I get you're probably an extrovert.
Yeah, a lot of people think because I'm quite such a strong kind of person, you know, they kind of think, oh, definitely extrovert, you know, wouldn't kind of mess with her vibe, you know.
Yeah.
But introverts can still be gregarious people. I mean, I enjoy talking, I enjoy doing this,
I don't actually think that's, you know, dare I say, I don't think, like, saying someone's extrovert and introvert is actually that useful. And the reason I say that is because I think most people, Mike Myers, the comedian who did Austin Powers, said, and I quote him all the time, because everyone always says that I'm very extrovert, because I just think I'm sociable, but I'm sociable at the time that I want to be sociable. That's why I get annoyed when, because that's why I don't like being labeled as an extrovert, because what made me unhappy in my teens is I'd be invited to parties because they'd be like, he's always extrovert, he's always up, he's always funny. I'm like, no, if I decide to go to a sociable event, I'm going to be like that because I've decided to be like that. But as my partner says in Quality Time, and you've been around me in meetings and stuff like that, I actually am quite introverted.
I think the line in between is becoming blurred now as
So Mike Myers said he's a site-specific extrovert and an introvert the rest of the time. And he actually went on to say, I think actually most humans are like that.
Yeah,
I think we're mostly more introverted than we are. And I don't think there's anything, but I think the reason I say I think it's not useful to define people as that is that we are them aspects at different times, and that doesn't mean that when you're introverted you have to be extroverted or extroverted you have to be introverted. It's site specific, like you're saying. So anyway, that wraps things up. The one thing I wanted to ask though is to say about future stuff, because we didn't necessarily talk about Back to Balance too much, but obviously we're here in the place. So what's the sort of, because you've been here 18 months like we touched on at the beginning, what's your sort of future aspirations in regards to Back to Balance? Are you thinking of expanding it
Absolutely.
Or that kind of thing?
That's always been on the cards. We'd love to have two more Back to Balance
Great.
Units.
In not different like cities?
Different,
or?
Yeah, different, not necessarily up here in the northeast mm-hmm. even. So we haven't quite pinpointed where they are due to be. Mm-hmm. And then, because, as I've said to you, my passion is the retreat, I'd love to have an off, you know, Claire and I've spoken about an off the grid mm-hmm. type retreat where people nice. Really come and just disconnect completely. And mm. we have key therapies, key brilliant. Classes, and it's really to recalibrate. Mm-hmm. And it's self-sustainable, you know, where everything is, you know, growing mm. on the land. So it's self-sustainable.
That sounds wonderful.
I can see it having quite a big potential.
I mean, because
up here would definitely need
that's the bit like, you know, because it's like the Priory Rehab in, for down south, which celebrities go to. It was all like, you know, but why does it necessarily have to be until you need rehab to be in them sort of isolated environments? I don't really. So having an opportunity for someone to go, I think I need to just get away from life a little bit. Because then I actually find there's a good summary about when I was in a psychiatric ward, it served no purpose to me because I wasn't like necessarily like I was a danger to myself, but like I guess more people who end up there, from what I could gather, are from people who are going to hurt other people as well as that. It's sort of the double edged sword. Mm. But the way that it didn't help me, what I think it actually did for me is because I was so having so many episodes and being so external in my like anger and frustration, it got me to condense my thoughts into a confined area. Mm. So even though I couldn't leave or whatever it was, that just gave me a break from the chaos that is my life and got me to sit in a room. Mm. Ironically, I've thought about this a lot, and I think that something like that would have been far more beneficial for me because all I did was sit in my room, got through what I needed to, and talk to a psychologist like twice a day and for a month, and then basically started to feel like myself again. And I think that's just when things get overwhelming and on top of you and you've got symptoms of something like a disorder like I do, just getting away from life and having a break. That's why I don't think, I mean, there's another conversation to go into. I don't think people take enough holidays or downtime. That's another thing I think English people are a bit reluctant to do, like, you know, we can't take time off. Like, anyone with mental health issues feel guilty, I think, and don't take the time off. It's been wonderful talking to you, Nathan.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, good. I was about to ask you, I felt like you let your guard down. you were all like relaxed and all like going like, well, yeah, what I do for fun time is, you know, I think you recommend it. It's awesome. It was great. It was really fun. Did you have a good time?
Yeah, I liked it,
yeah. Yeah, it's really nice and what a fantastic place. And thank you for inviting
thank
us.
Thank you. Yes, thank you for coming.
Yeah, it's been really nice.
Much better than we expected.
What? What?
I expected, because you see, we came with this corporate...
You expected a shithole. No. I finally said my answer.
And you were being the business park, and I was thinking, oh, how's this going to be? Because the juxtaposition is really interesting.
Yeah.
But I knew, literally on the banks, and I was like, wow, we really, really are on the banks.
Yeah, what a wonderful place. I mean, I said that at the beginning. I mean, we've been just looking at the river going past and stuff
just
like that.
Just the sun glistening behind you. It's all serene and, you know, I could paint a picture like that.
Now. I mean, we have, as I said, that joke about the champagne, we haven't been drinking right then. It was for a water thing, but, I mean, the only thing missing from this is, like, wine and cheese or something, and then we'd have everything we needed.
That's another kind of therapy.
And part two. We're just going to record part two
part
now.
Part two. We'll just record
gonna record. It's gonna be entirely different. It's gonna be the conversation we're gonna talk about now. Anyway, we're gonna wrap things up. Thanks so much, Nikki.
Thank you.
And on the podcast, like you always end the ways of the great B-movie Robot Trash Crash and Burn, and we'll see you very soon for another edition of the Geek Apocalypse podcast. But thank you to Nikki and to Ricky, and thanks for taking care. Bye.
Bye,
guys.